My name is Antje Dubois-Pedein from the Faculty of Law, and I welcome you here on behalf of the Cambridge Transitional Justice Research Network for the first public lecture organized by this network when I was trying to advertise the lecture, I thought, okay, it should commemorate the end of the Second World War, but what label am I going to put on the day, on my lecture heading? Eventually, I settled for VE Day. That's what the Americans call it, Victory in Europe. The European countries on the continent, for the most part, have a different denomination. They call it the Day of Liberation, and it's quite clear it is the day when they were finally officially freed from Nazi occupation. The Germans simply used to call it the Day of Unconditional Surrender. And that was meant to be descriptive. Tag der bedingungslosen Kapitulation. It was associated with simply the day on which the war ended, on which the fact that we had lost the war voluntarily was made official. And when I grew up, I remember that the day was, you know, usually seen as quite a solemn occasion. There wouldn't be any public celebrations as there might be in other European countries. It was a sort of a gloomy day. People thought of all the things that had been bad about the war and about its aftermath. The country lay in ruins. Germany was disempowered, occupied, split up into administrative zones. Eventually, it split into two countries. But 40 days after the event in 1985, the then president of the Federal Republic of Germany, Richard Weizsäcker, gave a speech in which he, for the first time, suggested that perhaps even the Germans should think of this day as a day of liberation. It didn't go down too well, especially with members of his own party. Not too many at the time, I think, were ready for this idea. And yet, it obviously liberated Germany from a government that had become oppressive to many Germans themselves as well, but that people didn't have the strength to overthrow. And if one thinks of it in the longer term, perhaps it liberated Germans politically in a deeper sense from a long tradition of authoritarianism and of unquestioning obedience to authority. So the day on which things officially fell apart was also a day where a new democratic Germany ultimately had its beginning. And now this lecture is about this time of beginnings. It is about denazification as an element of a policy that was designed to make a democratic Germany possible. And the speaker will talk about what it involved, whether it was made to work, and if so, what made it work. And so it is a topic that has great contemporary relevance because we often find ourselves with the aftermath of conflict and with occupiers, friends, advisors going into nations currently who are trying to rebuild themselves as democratic countries, democratic nations. And one sometimes wonders whether they have a very clear idea of what they're doing. They may have clear objectives, but do they have a sense of the path that could lead them to reaching those objectives? My speaker, Professor Uta Gerhard, studied sociology and did her PhD with Ralf Dahrendorf many, many years ago when he was still at the University of Konstanz. And she then worked for many years in London, in Gießen, and in Heidelberg. And I think it was really after about the mid-80s that she became fascinated with what made Germany work as a political entity after the war and over the 60s, over the 70s. And she went into the archives in the United States to find out what the preparation, what the planning for the post-war period had been, and how this had been implemented, and published a number of very, very interesting books. They tend to have German titles, so and they refer to this particular moment, the moment where the war ends and everything that is democratic Germany begins in some way, as the Stunde Null. So that is a phrase that that is used in Germany very often for this. And so we have the sociology of this Stunde Null, the 0 hour, and we have books addressing emigres and remigration into Germany after the Second World War. And we have today a presentation of research findings that relate to that particular directed strategy of the American government, with which the other allies eventually cooperated as well, on denazification. I would hand over at this point to my speaker after switching on her microphone. So just give me a second for that.
So, my lecture is called After Unconditional Surrender, the Role of Denazification in US Policy After World War II. The policy of unconditional surrender against Nazi Germany in World War II was first proposed by President Franklin Roosevelt in a personal statement on the occasion of the Casablanca Conference in January of 1943, with Prime Minister Winston Churchill consenting inasmuch as he never voiced his doubts in public. The Declaration of Unconditional Surrender of June 5, 1945, stated that the supreme authority with respect to Germany rested with the four occupying powers. War crime suspects would be arrested. Political, administrative, economic, financial, military, and other changes would be carried out. And Germans had to fully comply with all such proclamations, orders, ordinances, and instructions. My lecture to that sort of the basic situation. My lecture today, on the day of the 67th anniversary of May 8, 1945, the day when the Act of Unconditional Surrender was signed, deals in three parts with denazification in the context of the transformation after World War II. I venture that ritual elements were involved, which in turn open up a new perspective regarding the democratization of Germany or any kind of abysmal dictatorship as Germany was at the time. Part one documents that unconditional surrender meant also psychological disarmament, what, as it was called, a moral mission to end German aggressiveness. The Potsdam Agreement envisaged the occupation as a regime that would help turn Germany into a peaceful nation. Problem was how. Part two reconstructs from historic sources the two prongs and different phases of denazification. The dynamics of the policy and procedure that I picture were not understood by the Germans, who were highly critical of the results. The rationale given the policy by the military governor, however, tells a different story, which I shall mention. Part three looks at denazification as the unheralded success that it was. Ritual elements, I think, can help explain the role of denazification in US occupation policy after World War II on two different counts. Ritual process was involved, and a ritual that emulated medieval practice of peacekeeping was also operative. The conclusion is that pre-modern patterns of policy were needed in order to change the Germany that was sort of sunk into crime. So my first part is the psychological mission of unconditional surrender. You have to realize what I'm trying to delineate is really 4 or 6 years of hard work. But this did not come to the people easily, who eventually sort of put all this into their handbooks and their plans and their programs. There's a long, long story of thinking, build up this kind of conception, a story in which the British were heavily involved. I only take the American perspective at the moment, but another part of the problem of the story is that the British were part of it, in some ways, actually in many ways. Although they never agreed with some of the American ideas. When Nazi propaganda cried out that unconditional surrender, that was the official policy since January 43, would mean extermination of the German nation and people. The Joint Chiefs of Staff in Memorandum JCS 718, February 20, 1944, warned that in effect the policy might prolong the war. Assistant Secretary of War John J. McCloy disagreed, asserting instead that the Germans were being taught a lesson they would never forget. Quote, "In the long run, if they fight it out and then suffer the incidents of occupation, there's a much better chance of their concluding that these perennial tries at domination do not pay." Unquote. To note, McCloy hinted at Germany's wantonly launching wars, which of course later the Nuremberg trial established as one of the sort of three lines along which German guilt was to be seen. President Roosevelt knew that only unconditional surrender would bring about the change of German philosophy, as he called it, when otherwise, quote, of necessity, a period of quiet would be followed by a Third World War. He wrote to Churchill, "Only inevitability of defeat ensured, quote, total destruction of philosophy of those Germans who have announced that they could subjugate the world," unquote. And you have to keep in mind the Holocaust is in the background of all this. This is contemporary. In the late summer of 1944, the Handbook Governing Policy and Procedure for the Military Occupation of Germany, a document like that, the Scheff Post-Hostilities Handbook delineated the unlimited powers over German persons and property that were necessary, warned of German evasion and obstruction of the terms of surrender, and decreed non-fraternization. The handbook detailed the consequences of unconditional surrender, recollecting that the Prussians, after 1805, had violated the terms in their defeat in the Napoleonic Wars, and after 1919, the Germans had done likewise after Versailles. So a third time this shouldn't happen. Another upsurge of aggressive nationalism would happen, they said, unless the Allied force exploit to the utmost what was called the unique psychological opportunity, lasting probably only a very short period, when the Germans were open, so to speak, for shock and awe. The writing was on the wall, quote, "Any neglect to inflict condign punishment for an act of disobedience will be regarded by the Germans as an encouragement to build up and stiffen resistance all along the line," unquote. The moral factor, as it was called then, was to instill in them humility. Quote, "Unless the overwhelming nature and consequences of defeat can be so thoroughly driven home over a period long enough to that the Germans will once and for all renounce their former ways, history will repeat itself once more." Unquote. And I don't think that this was unrealistic. It was absolutely realistic thinking. Non-fraternization required every single officer and soldier in attitude and behavior to express cool distance, calm firmness vis-a-vis Germans. Non-fraternization had first been suggested in 1944 in conduct of American personnel in Germany, a memorandum that raised the specter of German evasion and obstruction turning into arrogance as soon as the Americans would prove nice guys. Well, the attitude of cool hostility and distaste was meant to make it clear to the Germans that we hold them responsible for starting the war and that we are unable to forgive them their treatment of subject peoples, unquote. Notably, quote, "The mark we can leave upon them of our feelings in this regard will accomplish far more than war guilt clauses in a peace treaty," unquote. The moral factor, as seen in the Scheff Post-Hostilities Handbook, was not lost on the Handbook of Military Government in Germany, another document like that, and the directive to the Commander-in-Chief regarding the military government of Germany, the famous Directive 1067, the official outline of the occupation policy. Psychological come economic changes would serve, eventually, the preparation for an eventual reconstruction of German political life on a democratic basis, but that would only happen if the other purposes were in place. As soon as American troops entered a region in Germany and subsequently the 216 detachments of military government were established in the American zone, official life in Germany would terminate, and did terminate. That's this 0 hour, this sort of point where it all was kind of shut down. All political, legal, economic institutions were shut down and reopened only under American surveillance when the 4Ds, as it was called, were in place. These programs of purge preceded democratization, demilitarization, denazification, decentralization, and decartelization. For a few days, as in local government, or a year or more, as in the educational sector, German institutions remained closed while they were being denazified, etc., in preparation of the reconstruction of German life on a democratic basis. So much about this psychological side of conditional surrender. Now I would like to somehow explain a bit more what denazification entailed. My first part is structure and process of denazification. Denazification rendered into practice what the planners of the occupation had preached. The Handbook for Military Government ordered the dissolution of Nazi institutions, the elimination of Nazi personnel and appointment of non-Nazi public officials, the control of Nazi property and reorganization of the financial sector in government, the judiciary, the police, education and the economy. Actually, the whole society was kind of changed. Historian Michael Balfour, a former member of the British military government in Germany, thinks that, he says, denazification was no waste of efforts. That's how he expressed it. But deems the Nuremberg trial the only effective denazification that the Allied Control Council achieved. Balfour implies rightly that denazification had a two-pronged structure, one judicial and the other civil. The former, the judicial, targeted Nazi crimes, and the latter, employment and eventual rehabilitation. The two prongs have often been merged into one, which has led to the misnomer that denazification was punitive. It should be noted also that the civil prong comprised two stages. It was called the Law for Liberation from National Socialism and Militarism. You have that up there, it's in German on the left-hand side. Enacted in March 1946 was the benchmark between them. The phases have often been merged into one block, which in turn has led to denazification being judged flawed. It's really important to take all this apart. My reconstruction separates the judicial prong from the two phases that make up the civil prong. The judicial prong concerned Nazi suspects as listed in the wanted list, the Central Registry of War Criminals and Security Suspects who were apprehended by the thousand. In the months of May and June 1945 alone, some 500 suspects were arrested per day. They were taken for further investigation to internment camps, where over 100,000 were being held by the end of the year. The special camp destined for former industrialists was dubbed Ash Camp, and that for former political leaders, Dustbin, turning them into leftovers from some dishonored yesteryear. The Nuremberg Tribunal sat over 22 high Nazi officials in 10 months until October 1946. Its successor were a further 12 trials held at Nuremberg until 1949 against the Krupp and Flick industrialists, the Foreign Office, the Einsatzgruppen, the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, to name but some. Further tribunals at Buchenwald, Mauthausen and Dachau convicted a total of 1,416 defendants in 489 trials, with the war crimes branch of the theater judge advocate division accumulating 18 tons of court records. In addition, some 4,500 cases were brought to justice before German courts in the three western zones alone until 1949, when of course the Federal Republic was established and things changed. Military government no longer had to say so, and so then there was a kind of changeover. This remarkable effort marked the judicial side of the purge. The civilian prong, in its first phase, involved the Counterintelligence Corps, CIC, and the special branches, whose task was public safety. They screened for possible Nazi background and submitted to a personal interview every individual German who held or applied for a job. This removal from office program involved, and now comes a quote from a contemporary source, Elmar Plischke, all Germans used by military government in public or quasi-public office were required to fill out a detailed personnel questionnaire called the Fragebogen. The purpose was to enable military government to determine whether a person should be removed or excluded from the position he held or sought to hold, unquote. The categories given the applicants ranged from unconditional removal through conditional removal and conditional approval to unconditional approval, the latter securing employment for those who had been marginalized under the Nazis. So you had a kind of turning around of the system. To be sure, whenever new evidence came to light, the investigation could be reopened despite previous approval, which of course people didn't like. At all. That was poo-pooed. In September 1945, law number 8 extended the program to business and industry, relinquishing ex-Nazis, ex-Nazi sympathizers and militarists to mere ordinary labor. In October 1945, a committee chaired by the military government legal advisor Charles Fahy, a former attorney general, so that's like Minister of Justice, I mean, it's very high up. Office that he had held, to chair this committee, members of which were the ministers of justice of the newly founded Länder, and they decided upon a reform of denazification. The American administered program ended officially on May 31st, 1946. Military government had taken action in nearly 1.5 million cases. And Plischke comments, this means that virtually 1 out of every 10 persons in the American zone, adults and children alike, were subject to this denazification process. So that's the first phase, now comes the second phase. The law for liberation from National Socialism and Militarism, signed on March 5, 1946, made 3 major changes to the previous setup. Now come those 3 changes. The first change was, whereas the principle of punishment continued to apply in the ongoing tribunals against Nazi criminals, that the principle of reparation was now being introduced. The purpose of the liberation from fascist militarism, stated the preamble of the law, was to exclude from any influence upon public and economic life all those who are guilty of having violated the principle of justice and humanity. Responsibility meant that those who had violated these principles, quote, shall be bound to make reparations. That is, quote, everyone who is responsible shall be called to account. At the same time, he shall be given full opportunity to defense, unquote. So that's the first change, principle of reparation. Second change was that the authority, how the policy was being administered, passed from military government whose control remained in place to the German Länder governments that did the work. The Länder prime ministers and newly appointed ministers of denazification set up court-like chambers in each district called Spruchkammern, chaired by a judge who had no Nazi background. The Spruchkammern decided on cases referred to them by the specially appointed public prosecutors. 5 categories applied, depending on the person's Nazi entanglement or evil activities. Class 1 targeted major offenders, class 2 offenders or militarists, class 3 lesser offenders, class 4 followers with no serious Nazi involvement, class 5 non-offenders, the exonerated. The Spruchkammern sentenced class 1 offenders to prison or labor camp for forfeiture of property or loss of certain civil rights. Class 2 and 3 received lesser judgments. Class 4 were given fines, class 5 went free altogether. The judgments were not given indiscriminately, to note, because that was always said, that was charged, and it wasn't true. But in the individual case, a testimony from a witness might mitigate the judgment. And nevertheless, I mean, it was a huge workload being worked through. The third change was that now the program reached the entire German population. Every adult over the age of 18 was required to fill in and submit for further processing the revised Fragebogen, now called Meldebogen. providing information on his membership in the Nazi Party plus any of the 52 affiliated FL associations, and also revealing the financial means until 1945. The information provided was checked against documentation now amply accessible to CIC and public safety on Nazi organizations, income statistics and the like. Falsification of the information notably was prosecuted by military government courts, and people did go to jail because they had falsified their Fragebogens. In other words, denazification now reached every German adult who could be summoned before a German manned special chamber, the Spruchkammer. So these were the sort of important changes, and I'll come to that. I had to go through these details so that you can then relate the comment and the reactions and the explanations to this as how it was. So my second point about denazification is cause of denazification, resonance among the Germans, and rationale given by the Americans who masterminded it. The non-judicial prong, especially in the Spruchkammer era, drew heavy criticism for leniency as well as harshness. Some Americans, often former German exiles, feared renazification from the return to public life of Nazis whitewashed in the purge. One such voice, John H. Hertz, political scientist, described what he deemed the fiasco of denazification as ex-Nazis became ordinary Germans to the politics of the emerging Cold War, saying that everywhere in Europe were purges of fascists, and they had now been perverted into tools of the power politics of the two major power blocks. On the other hand, most German critics and some former exiles, now naturalized Americans, decried the harshness of Spruchkammer's judgments. Social Research, the sociology journal edited at the New School for Social Research in New York, published a 15-page letter from a German anti-Nazi lawyer to his friend, as it said, an American scholar, full of bitter resentment. The writer complained that denazification points to the really guilty only by sheer accident, when he also thought that party membership, the presumptive criteria for Nazi entanglement, was, quote, much too superficial and misleading an indication of guilt, unquote. Similarly, Hannah Arendt, philosopher come political thinker, in her report on Germany, written in 1950, lamented that former Nazis and non-Nazis were now united in their protest against denazification, and she ridiculed the moral intentions of the Americans because, supposedly, there were no moral feelings left in the Germans after the terror of Nazism. That's the what's called a report of on Germany. And the essay is called The Aftermath of Nazi Rule. Statistics give a picture of why contemporary Americans saw leniency, although Germans still decried harshness. The denazification branch of military government observed there were 584,000 cases being processed by the public prosecutor in 5 months, and 530,000 of them were seen as unaffected, therefore exempt from further investigation. Among the remaining, still about 50,000 cases, only 116 were sentenced as major offenders, but 1,000 offenders, about 3,000 minor offenders. By July 1947, out of the total of approximately 12 million Germans who had submitted their Fragebogen, 8.7 million had been found unaffected by the public prosecutor. Out of the nearly 3 million cases chargeable and 2.3 million completed cases, less than 50,000 had been judged offenders of any category, but four times that many had been judged followers or non-offenders by the Spruchkammer and had gone free. In addition, two amnesties had been granted by the military government in 1946, which further reduced the number of cases by 2 million. The young, with the exception of former SS officers or Hitler Youth leaders, and all disabled or those with low income during the Nazi period went free. In 1948, prisoners of war were also amnestied. So you can see how that became a problem to some of the contemporary people, that they couldn't see how this could work. The denazification program ended officially on April 1st, 1949, but the chamber sat over cases still pending well into the 1950s. One dismayed historian remarked in 1950, he was an American historian, Griffiths, that 1,600 had been judged class one and 20,000 class two offenders, and only 22,000 were still eligible to hold public office from 12 million who had been in the program. Out of the millions scrutinized in the program, the Federal Republic of Germany, however, did not consider denazification its priority, but exonerated and freed from restrictions all those who had been charged by a Spruchkammer. Law number 131, promulgated in 1951, established full equality between previous offenders and the exonerated. So that belongs then into the history of the Federal Republic. The policy involved clemency even for those who were Nazi criminals and had been sentenced as Nazi criminals. On March 1st, 1950, about 1,300 convicted were still serving their sentences. 2 years later, however, the High Commissioner had converted the sentences of many, pardoned some altogether. Only 740 were still in prison. On July 1st, only 95 were still behind bars. Eventually, one could say, among the 3,300 held in prisons outside Germany, Netherlands, France, and so on, only 14 of them in France, were made to serve their full sentences. So we had this kind of reduction and this kind of clemency, even including the Nazi criminals. Despite such noteworthy leniency, even clemency, a sizable majority in Germany complained about what appeared to them as undue harshness of the programme. Surveys conducted by the Public Opinion Branch of the Information Control Division between 1945 and 1949 documented what the Germans thought of the programme as it unfolded. A week after the law for liberation had come into effect, people said, well, they appreciated that now the guilty were going to be punished, but somehow they thought that denazification was no good anyway. Less than a year later, denazification, as the Americans said, as now carried out by the Germans under American scrutiny, was approved by 34%, about one-third said they were satisfied with it. The others were unsatisfied to sort of varying degrees. And those poor little researchers who had these findings to comment on, they said, people who are dissatisfied because verdicts are too lax tend to favor giving all authority to the Americans. Those who express dissatisfaction because they think Spruchkammer actions are too harsh prefer the present way, which means confusion all over. The researchers found, quote, public sentiment was firmly behind a forgive and forget policy. And a more general trend applied also. Quote, a large body of the public most frequently thought National Socialism a good idea, only badly carried out. So that was one of the standard questions. You have a history of the answer to that question between late 45 and 49. At the end of the military government era in July 1949, looking back over the 4 years of the denazification program, 17% that said they were satisfied with what had been done the right way, 65%, two-thirds, judged it the wrong way, and 18% had no opinion. So you had about 80% who said it was no good. All this, what had been done. The researchers hastened to comment, quote, decline in satisfaction as well as adverse criticism of denazification procedures do not necessarily imply hostility to the idea of denazification, unquote. To be sure, few Americans, not even historian William Griffith, who had served in Germany until 49 and devoted his PhD dissertation at Harvard to German denazification, lauded the program. Griffith lamented, now in another quote, abandoned by the Americans and universally denounced by the disgusted Germans, denazification had failed and the effort to construct democratic foundations for German society and thus prevent a recrystallization of its traditional authoritarian social structure had probably failed with it. Unquote. 1950. Howard. Deputy Military Governor Clay, however, was convinced all the same that it was wise to incorporate the Germans into the procedure. When the Spruchkammern were run by Germans and all Germans had to submit to filling out the Fragebogen. Less than a year after unconditional surrender, Clay had said to President that his contemporaries found utterly unreasonable. What rationale was behind the policy? When the New York Times called the youth amnesty of 1946 an invitation for return into public life of former SS men by the million, Mrs. Charlotte W. Clark from Haverstraw, New York, in a personal letter to Clay, expressed her utter concern about his colossal mistake. And Clay, in a handwritten note, answered her, quote, "If we punished and made outcasts of all German youth, we would have a huge void in the population which would not respond to democratic teachings." Unquote. Some 2 years later, Assistant Secretary of State for the Occupied Areas, John D. Hildring, who as head of the Civil Affairs Division of the War Department until 1946 had organized and controlled military government, clarified the purpose of the occupation of Germany. He said, 80 million Germans who live in it, he said, thereby targeting all inhabitants of all four zones should run their country without Nazi influence. Quote, "The heart and soul of our policy in Germany is to turn the country over to the German people. The first step in that direction was to remove from control those National Socialists who have been in control of all sections of German society for the last 15 years. The aim was, quote, that they are replaced by Germans who are sympathetic to our ways of life, and or more sympathetic than the Nazis. Denazification and other elements of our implementation program," he said, "were not vindictive. Many a Nazi still was not converted to peaceful ways yet, though. Quote, there is still a lot of sin to be cast out, and that sin can only be cast out by the Germans." Unquote. In other words, denazification, which fitted America's original purpose towards Germany, these are the words of Hildring, helped laying the foundation for democracy in Germany. Clay, in his memoirs, characterized denazification much along the same lines as Hildring. In Decision in Germany, these are his memoirs, Clay recollected how he had made the Länderrat, the assembly comprising the three Länder of the American zone, accept the responsibility for denazification. The law for liberation, he knew, made future Germany safer. Quote, "It recognized that the great mass of Nazi followers could not be kept forever from German economic and public life without creating a cancerous growth in the body politic which might well destroy democratic progress in Germany." Unquote. Clay assured the three minister presidents of the four principles in the policy when he signed the law. These principles are the complete elimination of Nazi and militaristic influence from German life, which was all important to the Allies. Germans who had been merely passive participants in the Nazi Party should speedily regain their civil rights. The procedure of Spruchkammern gave, quote, the German people an opportunity to participate actively in the elimination of Nazism and militarism. And, last but not least, echoing JCS 1067, quote, "This is a large step forward in the reconstruction of German life on a democratic basis." Unquote. So much for, say, the history of denazification and the resonance that it had with the Americans and with the Germans, and also the rationale that those who were responsible, Clay and Hildring, gave for how the program was being handled. Now comes my third part, where I venture on my hypothesis, the dynamics of denazification and the place of ritual in history. The discrepancy between the rationale that Hildring and Clay gave denazification, these masterly minds masterminding the policy, and the judgment given denazification not only by post-war Germans, but also German historians until today, needs examination urgently. To place denazification in the context of the transformation of Germany from belligerence to prosperity, from dictatorship to democracy, the interim regime of military government may hold the key. The question arises, what made the interim regime, while powers lodged with the four allies as Germany had forfeited its sovereignty, the venue for denazification meant as a preparation for democratization? American policymakers considered the Nazi regime atavistic, I think rightly so, inasmuch as nihilism had destroyed humanism. Thus, the immediate post-war regime had to acknowledge that only few, if any, vestiges of civilization had been left intact. The policy after unconditional surrender had to reintroduce human dignity in the nation marred from aggressiveness. US policy, indeed the policy adopted by all four occupying powers, aimed at this atavistic inhumanity that should be eliminated forever. Germany had to be purged from the paranoid cum megalomaniac nationalism that dated back to the 19th century pan-Germanism. Constitutional historian Saul K. Padova, who as psychological warfare division officer had witnessed the aftermath of unconditional surrender, deemed the task impossible still in 1947 when he wrote, quote, "The problem is not merely one of eradicating Nazism, but also of eliminating authoritarianism, militarism, Junkerism, and racism," unquote. Harvard political scientist Carl J. Friedrich in 1943 had foreseen the paradox when he wrote, quote, "Constitutional authority conferred by the American people upon the President of the United States was being used in a way alien to American democracy to re-establish the rule of law in lands which have been deprived of that first condition of self-rule," unquote. An analytical model that helps explain the logic of denazification in this context may take account of the fact that German society was being restructured in toto. The entire society had to be sort of revamped. A sociological thesis may be in order. Sociologist cum cultural anthropologist Arnold van Gennep, he taught in Paris, he was sort of in the entourage of Emile Durkheim, in 1909, used material from tribal Africa and Australia to show in The Rites of Passage how ritual has deep roots in the societal history of mankind. A three-stage process, understands Van Gennep, is the pattern that allows for transition, ensuring that everyone is being carried over from one status group to another, which in turn reconstitutes the social order. The rites of passage, says Van Gennep, are not the same in all societies, but three stages may be distinguished. The first is separation that ends a previous condition, such as in tribal society, initiation ends childhood when, quote, "the transition means giving up an old life and turning over a new leaf," unquote. Second, liminality, he calls it that. Liminality is the transient phase of purges accompanied by what he calls threshold rites. The third stage is incorporation, that is integration into mainstream society for one, of the men in tribal societies after they have undergone initiation. And what is important, all men undergo initiation and the transient state, which Van Gennep calls liminality, is analyzed further by cultural anthropologist Victor Turner. In his seminal The Ritual Process, Turner takes examples from rural Africa, but also medieval Europe, to explain what he also sees in the nation building of Mexico in the 19th century, the ritual process as a pattern. Political and social change, suggests Turner, involves transition, and one phase is the liminal period, which involves what he calls communitas. Existential communitas, says Turner, makes all the members equal. As hierarchies disappear and privileges are scrapped, and humility reigns supreme. As a next step, rituals in status reversal, or what he calls status reversal, ensue, preparing for the novel social order. Those newly entrusted with responsibility, says Turner, feel like neophytes. In any case, like all others, they have been through the ordeals and penance of the liminal period. The thesis, to note, stands out for its originality, and one critic says very nicely, Turner's major insight is that ritual is a primary means of social change. It generates new alternative social arrangements in its transformative capacity. That's an American scholar who wrote this book, Victor Turner Revisited, Ritual as Social Change. Denazification, the two-pronged policy with a punitive and a civil wing, I argue, may invoke the pattern of ritual process in several respects. And that may explain what to the contemporaries was so difficult to explain, why it was handled in this way, and why it worked. 3 points for discussion I want to put up. 1 point, Germany under the Allied Control Council had no sovereignty. It was a nation without a state for 4.5 years, during which military government reigned supreme and had to make sure that necessary changes were made. So in a way, it was a liminal period for Germany. Furthermore, there were 3 stages in the transition. You can say separation was when Nazism ended. The liminal period was when the say-so of the occupying forces counted most, whereas Germans were reduced to strict obedience, the period which the various handbooks and directives laid out. And eventually, incorporation, when the Federal Republic was established, a parliamentary democracy, come market economy, come Rechtsstaat. Another noteworthy fact, the 4 Ds, these were denazification, demilitarization, decentralization, decartelization, were tailor-made for the interim period, when the German nation was in limbo, and reliable Germans had to be found who could run an institution on a democratic basis. So these are sort of 3 points where I think that one can sort of uphold the hypothesis that this is really sort of how this transition can be likened to a ritual process. Maybe that is why it worked. Denazification had 2 further specifics that invoke an image of ritual process. For one, in the American-controlled early phase, denazification was directed at all Germans who held a job or applied for a position, when every applicant was being screened by CIC and Special Branch. There were no exceptions. This, it seems, was communitas in the sense of Turner. In the later phase, under the Spruchkammern, every German had to fill in the Meldebogen, no exceptions allowed, and every citizen had to be summoned for trial, although not everybody was so treated. This, again, seems to have established some kind of communitas, a feature of liminality. Also, when desertification ended, every German had gone through the ordeal one way or another, and everyone was now a normal citizen. The exonerated, as well as those who had been sentenced to reparations that involved rehabilitation. In the long run, denazification had the same outcome for everyone, no matter whether an offender or not. All were free to enter social life as a normal citizen. I see this behind the rationale given by Clay and by Hildring. They say otherwise a resentiment population would arise. This is the cancerous growth, and so that would hinder democratization. These striking similarities with the pattern of ritual process provide interesting food for discussion, and that's all I want to do. However, the question also arises, how does unconditional surrender fit into the picture? I can see a connection between the psychological mission of unconditional surrender and another type of ritual, one dating from medieval history. It irks me that in Germany, denazification is vilified as vindictive on the side of the victors, when indeed it may have been one type of purification that has turned over a new leaf, to quote from von Chanep. So the emotionality with which Germans speak of denazification is really an issue to take note of. And that is sort of a baseline for what I'm going to hypothesize now. When Jacob Beam proposed non-fraternization, he was the author of this memorandum on conduct of American military personnel. The cool and distant conduct of the occupation personnel, he expected that Germans would be unnerved, even angered by the behavior. And he wanted that. The experience, said Beam, should make the Germans realize that they were not forgiven the cruelties they had committed during the war. Quote, "Our feelings in this regard will accomplish far more than war guilt clauses in a peace treaty," unquote. To remember, Roosevelt wanted to impress upon Germany the inevitability of defeat, which he said was instrumental in the total destruction of the philosophy of those Germans who have announced that they would subjugate the world, unquote. Ritual as a practice to shame an offender has a place in medieval history. Gerd Althoff, in Die Macht der Rituale, analyzes the political ritual named deditio in medieval Europe. The ritual when the victor subjugates the defeated aggressor in a ceremony to humiliation that makes him mend his ways forever. Alternatively, he has to suffer severe punishment. Quote from Althoff, "Rituals of submission render the defeated the object of clemency or else punishment." Such ritual humiliations, finds Althoff, served to expose the aggressor and enforce his peacefulness. The dictate of obedience is brought home to him through ritual humiliation, and only unconditional submission allows for eventual restoration of him as a full member in the community. This aspect of ritual, I think, is fascinating when the high emotionality is looked at with which sort of Germans utter negative reactions to denazification and vilify it in a way that I still find very strange and very... So there needs to be an explanation for why they cannot just see it without seeing an era at studio for what it was, an attempt at and so on to turn over a new leaf. But the hatred and the emotion is very strong with which denazification is remembered. So there's something in it that, is then, that needs to sort of be brought out. And I think it had to do with this psychological mission of unconditional surrender. My suspicion is that the moral factor which the post-hostility handbook invoked was effective after all. It may have been ritual humiliation for former high-up party members to fill in the Meldebogen like everybody else, let alone members of the master race, and be subject to the judgment of a Spruchkammer chaired by a former enemy of the Nazi regime and have to submit to their judgment. It might have been ritual humiliation that the accused had to beg for testimony by witnesses that would help whitewash them if possible. In a word, ritual humiliation may have been experienced widely. That everyone was under the spell may have been a unique psychological opportunity that extended far into the length of the military government rule. To remember, McCloy had chided, quote, "If the Germans suffer the incidents of occupation, there's a much better chance of their concluding that these perennial tries at domination do not pay." Unquote. So much for my argument. I have a short conclusion. My lecture today has tried to provide a new perspective on the history after World War II. Unconditional surrender, I venture, had a connection with denazification and the 4 Ds. One of them was denazification, were important for post-war democratization. The Nazi regime was pre-modern. When the Americans made the Allies shoulder the enormous task of taking over the sovereignty of Germany during the occupation, They did so because they felt that this was the only way to re-establish humanism and free Germany from racism, elitism, and megalomania. It is an interesting thought that only pre-modern patterns may be effective in the overcoming of the pre-modern. Ritual elements may have been crucial in denazification to render it successful, at least insofar as post-war Germany became a stable democracy. My conjecture is that democratization resembled a ritual process when the program of denazification belonged into the liminal period and had itself certain features denoting liminality. I also contend that the act of individual denazification resembled the ritual humiliation known from medieval type practices. Well, what about the myth then that the justice served was that of the victors? Military government proclamation number one declared, quote, "We come as conquerors, but not as oppressors," unquote. The bestseller, The Conquerors, that was Michael Bischloss in 2002, pictures Americans loath to be just that. Harvard political scientist Friedrich met a young German in 1946 who told him, quote, "You pride yourself as conquerors, but you have liberated us just the same." Thank you very much. Thank you.